Christmas 1914 was marked by a spontaneous unofficial truce in Flanders, where German and British soldiers fraternized to no man's land, taking photographs, swapping souvenirs, and even playing football. On Christmas Eve, the soldiers in the field agreed not to fire on one another. That night, on a front where 5 days earlier there had been savage fighting, the guns fell silent. On the following morning, German soldiers walked across towards the British wire, and British soldiers went out to meet them.
Old no man's land, as far as we could see, was grey and khaki. There they were, smoking and talking, shaking hands, exchanging names and addresses after the war to write to one another.
The soldiers appeared with souvenirs, capstars and badges. The British gave the Germans plum pudding. The Germans invited their enemy into their trenches and serenaded them with Christmas songs. When the Germans began to bury some of their frozen dead, the British soldiers had another shock.
They would put the Germans for Vaterland und Freiheit, for Fatherland and Freedom. And I said to a German, excuse me, but how can you be fighting for freedom? You started the war, and we are fighting for freedom. And he said, excuse me, English comrade, but we are fighting for freedom, for our country. And I say, you also put, here rest in God, an unbekannter held. Here rest in God, an unknown hero in God. Oh yes, God is on our side. Blessed is on our side. Well, English comrade, do not let us quarrel on Christmas Day.
The day after Christmas, infantrymen of both sides shouted warnings to their opposite number before opening fire. Hardening attitudes, as the war became increasingly bloody and impersonal, ensured that such incidents on this scale would not recur. But live and let live understandings accepted by both sides frequently prevailed in quiet sectors until the end of the war.
Well, I don't know about hardening attitudes, but I do know that the commanders on both sides were extremely concerned about this spontaneous outbreak of peace and worked hard to stop such things happening again. And one of the strategies they came up with was the use of artillery, because this increased the distance between the fighting parties. Now, modern warfare, of course, is highly technological, and if we're talking about US warfare, it's highly asymmetric. So a lot of young things might be playing what appears to them to be something like a video game, and they're in fact raining down death on another side. But the potential for turning is there. So the Pentagon is also developing drugs to try to tackle PTSD, which it's medicalizing, not as a necessary reaction to the murder of one's fellow human beings, but as just another medical issue that can be solved if you take the right pills. They're also working on drugs that will completely erase the memory of atrocities committed, not of course out of compassion, but just to make the fighting units that much more efficient. But until they completely automate the killing process, there remains the possibility of a turning, which, considering how few psychopaths are running the show and how many people are the victim of sociopathic ideas, which are ultimately imposed on them and don't spring from their true feelings and their true desires, there remains the possibility of a turning, which, given modern communications technologies, would likely be a turning en masse. Now, let's have the final section of Jim Douglas talking about President Kennedy's turning.
In September, public opinion polls showed a turnaround. 80% of the American people were now in favor of the Test Ban Treaty. On September 24, 1963, the Senate approved the treaty by a vote of 80-19, 14 more than the required two-thirds. No other single accomplishment in the White House gave Kennedy greater satisfaction. On September 20th, Kennedy spoke to the United Nations. We're 2 months away from his death. He suggested that its members see the Test Ban Treaty as a beginning and engage together in an experiment in peace. He said, 2 years ago, I told this body that the United States had proposed and was willing to sign a limited test ban treaty. Today, that treaty has been signed. It will not put an end to war. It will not remove basic conflicts. It will not secure freedom for all. But it can be a lever. And Archimedes, in explaining the principles of the lever, was said to have declared to his friends, "Give me a place where I can stand and I shall move the world. My fellow inhabitants of this planet, let us take our stand here in this assembly of nations, and let us see if we, in our own time, can move the world to a just and lasting peace." When he said these words, John Kennedy was secretly engaging in another risky experiment in peace. The same day at the United Nations, Kennedy told UN Ambassador Adlai Stevenson that his assistant, William Atwood, should go ahead to make discreet contact with Cuba's UN Ambassador, Carlos Lechuga. The question, was Fidel Castro interested in a dialogue with John Kennedy? A strongly affirmative answer would come back from Castro, who had been repeatedly urged by Khrushchev to begin trusting Kennedy. After the Cuban Missile Crisis, Castro was furious with Khrushchev, more so than he was even with Kennedy, because Khrushchev had pulled his missiles out of Cuba without consulting Castro, withdrawing the deterrent to an American invasion from that capitalist president. And Castro wouldn't even communicate with Khrushchev. Khrushchev invited Castro over to Moscow and spent a month with him trying to reconcile with him the following spring. And in the midst of that reconciliation, he began a teach-in with Fidel Castro. The teach-in consisted of Khrushchev's reading his letters from Kennedy to Castro to show Castro how we can work with this man, the capitalist president. The following fall, when Kennedy said, "Are you interested?" Castro said, "Yes." They actually began that dialogue between themselves on normalizing U.S.-Cuban relations through the mediation of French journalist Jean Daniel, who personally visited both men in the month leading up to the assassination. Daniel went from the White House to Cuba. He was visited by Fidel, who sat with him all night and 6 hours into the next morning to ask him again and again, "Then what did Kennedy say? Then what did Kennedy say? Say it over again. I want to hear it exactly. Then what did Kennedy say?" Daniel was actually eating lunch with Castro in his home on November 22nd, conveying Kennedy's hopeful words when the Cuban premier was phoned with the news of Kennedy's death. Castro stood up and he said, "Everything is changed. Everything is going to change." On October 11, 1963, President Kennedy issued a top-secret order to begin withdrawing the U.S. military from Vietnam. In National Security Action Memorandum 263, he ordered that 1,000 U.S. military personnel be withdrawn from Vietnam by the end of 1963 and that all U.S. troops be taken out by the end of 1965. Kennedy decided on his withdrawal policy against the arguments of most of his advisors at a contentious October 2 National Security Council meeting when Defense Secretary Robert McNamara was leaving the meeting to announce the withdrawal to the White House reporters, the president called to him, "And tell them that means all of the helicopter pilots, too." In fact, it would not mean that at all. After JFK's assassination, his withdrawal policy was quietly voided. In light of the future consequences of Dallas, it was not only John Kennedy who was murdered on November 22, 1963, but 58,000 other Americans and over 3 million Vietnamese, Laotians, and Cambodians. On November 23, 1963, the day after Kennedy's assassination, Fidel Castro gave a speech on Cuban radio and TV in which he analyzed the wire service reports the day before that had instantly identified Lee Harvey Oswald as the assassin. Castro asked brilliantly obvious questions about Oswald that have been suppressed in our own media for decades. He asked, "Can anyone who has said that he will disclose military secrets, as Oswald said to the Soviet Union, return to the United States without being sent to jail?" How strange that this former Marine should go to the Soviet Union and try to become a Soviet citizen, and that the Soviets should not accept him, that he should say at the American embassy that he intended to disclose to the Soviet Union the secrets of everything he learned while he was in the U.S. service, and then in spite of this statement, his passage home is paid by the U.S. government. He goes back to Texas and finds a job. That is all so strange. Fidel Castro recognized CIA written all over Lee Harvey Oswald and the press releases on him that were being sent around the world within minutes of the assassination. The whole Dallas setup was obvious to someone as familiar with CIA assassination plots as Fidel Castro was. The plot to assassinate President Kennedy had an even more ambitious goal than killing the president. Its scenario was designed not only to murder JFK, but also to implicate the Soviet Union and Cuba in his murder so as to end the Cold War with a bang. The plot tried to suggest and dramatize a conspiracy between those two communist nations and their supposed agent, Lee Harvey Oswald, to assassinate Kennedy. Cuba and the Soviet Union could then be scapegoated and attacked for their presumably assassinating the president, who was, in fact, making peace with them. The plot did succeed in killing Kennedy, but it failed in its larger purpose, to win the Cold War by pinning the blame on the communists for killing JFK, thereby justifying an invasion of Cuba and a preemptive nuclear attack on the Soviet Union. If the plot had succeeded in its overall purpose, you and I would not be here talking about it. Lee Harvey Oswald was a U.S. counterintelligence agent. His previous role as a fake defector to the Soviet Union from 1959 to 1962 made him an ideal patsy in the assassination. Prior to his false defection, Oswald was a U.S. Marine stationed in 1957-58 at the Atsugi Naval Air Station in Japan, where he was a radar operator for the CIA's top-secret U-2 spy plane. From his time at Atsugi, Oswald was a CIA operative under the effective control of the CIA's counterintelligence branch, directed by James Jesus Angleton. When Oswald returned from his so-called defection to the Soviet Union in 1962, instead of being prosecuted, he was given a U.S. government loan. When he settled in Dallas with his Russian wife, Marina, and infant daughter, June, his closest friend and mentor was U.S. intelligence operative George DeMorenshield. During the summer of 1963, Oswald acted out the role of a provocative pro-Castro demonstrator in New Orleans. While he must have thought his purpose was to discredit the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, he was in reality being set up by the CIA to be identified later as a pro-Castro assassin in Dallas. In early September, CIA propaganda expert David Atlee Phillips met with Oswald in Dallas to direct his movements. In late September, a man identifying himself as Oswald made visits and phone calls to the Cuban and Soviet consulates in Mexico City. By wiretapping the phones at both consulates, the CIA's Mexico City station taped and transcribed the Oswald calls and tried to use the transcripts right after the assassination to implicate the Soviet Union and Cuba. When it became obvious that the man on the phone was not Oswald, his voice didn't match Oswald's, and in contrast to Oswald, he spoke terrible Russian, the CIA claimed the surveillance tapes had been routinely destroyed. Otherwise, they would have served as evidence of a plot initiated not by the Russians and the Cubans, but by the CIA. The plot originally called for JFK to be assassinated in Chicago on Saturday, November 2, 1963, when he was scheduled to attend a football game at Soldier Field. That was the day after South Vietnamese President Ngo Dinh Diem and his brother Nu were assassinated by a CIA plot in Saigon. The two CIA plots were likely being coordinated so that the Saigon murders could be blamed on President Kennedy, as they have been. Thus, it could be said in retrospect that Kennedy, from his supposedly ordering Diem's murder, got what he deserved in return. The Chicago plot to kill Kennedy has been exposed by former Secret Service agent Abraham Bolden, whose own book has just been published on this subject. And as a result, Abraham Bolden served 45 months in federal prison on trumped-up charges. The plot has also been investigated by journalist Edwin Black, the author of a series of classic books today on the Holocaust. The Chicago Secret Service apprehended two members of a four-man sniper team on the eve of Kennedy's scheduled trip. The men were then simply released. They vanished with no record of their arrest or identity ever found. Intelligence officers in the Chicago Police Department arrested at the same time Thomas Arthur Valley, a disturbed young man who had reportedly threatened to kill Kennedy. He bore the characteristics of a scapegoat. Thomas Arthur Valley was like Lee Harvey Oswald, an ex-Marine who had been stationed at a U-2 base in Japan, who worked later with the CIA as a paramilitary trainer, and who currently had a job located in a building directly over President Kennedy's scheduled parade route in Chicago. Valley's workplace, which I visited and looked down from, and has exactly the same perspective as from the Texas School Book Depository's sixth floor, that would have been actually even closer to JFK's limousine than Oswald's workplace. If Kennedy's trip to Chicago had not been canceled at the very last possible moment, you and I would likely never have heard of Lee Harvey Oswald. Thomas Arthur Valley would instead be remembered as the notorious assassin after being scapegoated and killed himself, with the actual snipers allowed to escape, as they were in both Chicago and Dallas. When the Secret Service drove JFK slowly into Dealey Plaza in Dallas and brought his limousine to a virtual stop, the president had been stripped of his security. The Secret Service agents who normally stood on the sides of his limousine to shield him from gunfire had been withdrawn to a car driven behind him. The police motorcycle escorts who also served to shield him had been similarly pulled back behind him, so they provided no barrier. Sniper teams went unchallenged as they took their positions in open windows above Dealey Plaza and behind the barriers at the top of the grassy knoll. The snipers, who carried not only rifles but also phony Secret Service credentials to ensure their escape, executed the president with crossfire from the grassy knoll, the Texas School Book Depository, and probably additional building and drain pipe locations. That night, military authorities controlled and falsified the autopsy at the Bethesda Naval Hospital in Maryland. Fraudulent x-rays and pictures were created. The Warren Commission then followed President Johnson's lead in backing away from the CIA's overly obvious claims of Cuban and Soviet involvement, which would have implicated the CIA itself, and indicted the dead scapegoat, Oswald, as only a lone assassin. And I apologize for summarizing 300 pages of evidence in three paragraphs. But anyhow, as we saw, Thomas Merton, in his premise for an assassination, was not so much a political plot as it was a spiritual breakthrough. That was his premise. A spiritual breakthrough by President Kennedy to depth, humanity, and a certain totality of self-forgetfulness and compassion, not just for individuals, but for humanity as a whole, a deeper kind of dedication. From his Trappist monastery in Kentucky, 1 year into JFK's presidency, Merton had hoped and prayed in a letter to a friend that maybe Kennedy will break through into that someday by miracle. 9 months after Merton wrote those words, Nikita Khrushchev, who was no more of a saint than John Kennedy was, helped Kennedy break through into that at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis by miracle, just as Kennedy at the same critical time helped Khrushchev break through by miracle. The form of the miracle was communication, respect, an agreement between two political enemies at the height of the most dangerous conflict in history. The two men then turned together at the risk of their lives and power toward the deeper kind of dedication Merton described. It was a breakthrough for humanity that, according to Merton's inexorable spiritual logic, marked out Kennedy for assassination. With no knowledge of any plots, Thomas Merton had understood that if Kennedy were to experience the deep change that was necessary for humanity's survival, he himself might not survive. JFK was deeply conscious of the risks he was taking for peace. He was not afraid of death. As a biographer observed, Kennedy talked a great deal about death and about the assassination of Lincoln. His conscious model for struggling truthfully through conflict and being ready to die as a consequence was Abraham Lincoln. On the day when Kennedy and Khrushchev resolved the missile crisis, JFK told his brother Robert, referring to the assassination of Lincoln, "This is the night I should go to the theater." Robert replied, "If you go, I want to go with you." They would both go soon. Kennedy prepared himself for the same end Lincoln met during his night at the theater, as we saw from Presidential Secretary Evelyn Lincoln's midnight discovery of the slip of paper JFK had written on. He had adopted Lincoln's prayer, "I know there is a God and I see a storm coming. If he has a place for me, I believe that I am ready." Kennedy loved that prayer. He cited it repeatedly. More important, he made the prayer his own. In his conflicts with Khrushchev, then more profoundly with the CIA and the military, he had seen a storm coming. If God had a place for him, he believed that he was ready. For at least a decade, JFK's favorite poem had been Rendezvous, a celebration of death. Rendezvous was by Alan Seeger, an American poet killed in World War I. The poem was Seeger's affirmation of his own anticipated death. The refrain of Rendezvous, "I have a rendezvous with death," articulated John Kennedy's deep sense of his own mortality. Kennedy had experienced a continuous rendezvous with death in anticipation of his actual death, from the deaths of his PT boat crew members from drifting alone in the dark waters of the Pacific Ocean, from the early deaths of his brother Joe and sister Kathleen, and from the recurring near-death experiences of his almost constant illnesses. He recited Rendezvous to his wife Jacqueline in 1953 on their first night home in Hyannis after their honeymoon. She memorized the poem and recited it back to him over the years. In the fall of 1963, Jackie taught the words of the poem to their five-year-old daughter, Caroline. On the morning of October 5, 1963, President Kennedy was meeting with his National Security Council in the White House Rose Garden. Caroline suddenly appeared at her father's side. She said she wanted to tell him something. He tried to divert her attention while the meeting continued. Caroline persisted. The president smiled and turned his full attention to his daughter. He told her to go ahead. While the members of the National Security Council sat and watched, Caroline looked into her father's eyes and said, "I have a rendezvous with death at some disputed barricade. When spring comes back with rustling shade and apple blossoms fill the air, I have a rendezvous with death when spring brings back blue days and fair. It may be he shall take my hand and lead me into his dark land and close my eyes and quench my breath. It may be I shall pass him still. I have a rendezvous with death on some scarred slope of battered hill when spring comes round again this year and the first meadow flowers appear. God knows 'twere better to be deep, pillowed in silk and scented down, where love throbs out in blissful sleep, pulse nigh to pulse and breath to breath, where hushed awakenings are dear. But I've a rendezvous with death at midnight in some flaming town, when spring trips north again this year, and I to my pledged word am true, I shall not fail that rendezvous." After Caroline said the poem's final word, rendezvous, Kennedy's national security advisors sat in stunned silence. One of them said later the bond between father and daughter was so deep it was as if there was an inner music he was trying to teach her. JFK had heard his own acceptance of death from the lips of his daughter while surrounded by a national security council that opposed his breakthrough to peace, and some of whom were probably plotting to kill him. The president once again deepened his pledge not to fail that rendezvous. If God had a place for him, he believed that he was ready. John Kennedy's decision to turn toward peace, regardless of the consequences to himself, is reason for gratitude. I think of him with gratitude, especially on Thanksgiving Day, which always falls around the anniversary of his assassination. Last Thanksgiving, November 22, 2007, coincided with the 44th anniversary of the gift of his life. Had JFK not turned and given his life, I believe the world would now be a nuclear wasteland. The fact that he did turn and was therefore murdered by an unspeakable power which continues to rule us today raises profound questions about our need to face the same darkness, to turn toward our own miracle of peace, and to accept the consequences as he did. It is our story, a story of hope. Yeah, the question is, what are the names and the faces of the people behind the assassination? I named a few of them. James Jesus Angleton, who's the counterintelligence chief of the CIA, who was moving Lee Harvey Oswald around the map. David Atlee Phillips was the chief propagandist of the CIA, who had met with Oswald in Dallas, and who was working the whole propaganda context of the assassination to move higher up. Richard Helms was in charge of covert action for the Central Intelligence Agency. And to move back a little bit and higher up still, Alan Dulles was fired by John Kennedy as a result of the Bay of Pigs invasion when he said, "I want to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds." And he scattered Mr. Dulles, first of all, as well as his director of covert action, Richard Bissell, as well as General Cabell, who was the deputy under Bissell. Alan Dulles, who had been in charge of our foreign policy along with his brother, John Foster Dulles, during Eisenhower's years, hated Kennedy as a result of that. And he continued to have huge influence within the CIA from outside its formal boundaries. And what then happened to Alan Dulles immediately after John F. Kennedy's assassination? He was appointed to serve on the Warren Commission. And the Warren Commission should have been called the Dulles Commission, the Alan Dulles Commission, because he was the major mover within the Warren Commission. So we have perhaps one of the highest, if not the highest, suspects in the Kennedy assassination investigating it, the Fox investigating the murder in the hen house. Yes, sir.
How could this have happened without some slip-ups or without anyone blowing the whistle?
There were many slip-ups, and there were many people who came forward. The question is, why didn't we hear about them? Why are we not aware of them? And why does it take 45 years for a certain amount of it to become public knowledge? There was a record, it was a very important law passed in 1992 called the JFK Records Act as a result of Oliver Stone's film, which appealed at the conclusion of the film for those who saw it and who felt strongly about it to demand that the government make public the records related to John F. Kennedy's assassination. That law was passed. And as a result, it's now a crime to keep secret any document or evidence related to the Kennedy assassination. And there's a huge building in College Park, Maryland, which I've visited and which many other researchers have visited, which has hundreds of thousands of documents newly revealed on John F. Kennedy's assassination. We will never find one that says, "We order you to assassinate the President of the United States." There are many documents that are there which can build up the story to show the context and to show the kind of details that I was summarizing, like that are developed in the whole story in terms of the specific witnesses and the specific facts as we go along. The pioneer investigators into John F. Kennedy's assassination, people like Mark Lane, Vincent Salandria, to give a couple of examples, already were uncovering the thing in the 1960s. You could already see the clear outlines of our own government responsibility. But huge efforts, propaganda efforts, were made to prevent us from seeing that, and a pouring of disinformation through the media, propaganda. All kinds of sub-characters were identified as the major players in the assassination rather than U.S. government agencies. There were many sub-players in the assassination, but that is not the key to the assassination. But the story and the outlines of it have been there for a long time. This is a question that you raise that's about ourselves, about our society, not just about our media, but about our denial, about the unspeakable. Why doesn't anybody want to go there? I include, incidentally, the left media. You can cite all your favorite left media people. They do not want to go there. They do not want to go there. And you can ask yourself the question, why don't they want to go there? All kinds of reasons.
Do you think that Lyndon Johnson knew about all this?
While all this being the whole thing, of course, no, I don't think he knew that at all. There's a woman named Madeline Brown, Lyndon Johnson's mistress, who wrote a book about her relationship to him and his saying the night before that he wouldn't have to deal with those damn Kennedys anymore, and saying similar things the night or the morning of the assassination. I didn't put that in the book because I didn't have a confirming witness, and I put only what I saw as so definitely proved that I could establish it clearly.
Have you got any strategies for justice and peace to suggest?
Well, I am very much aware by looking around at the people who are here today, there are a number of folks who are deeply and profoundly involved in struggles with strategies for justice and peace. I don't have anything radically new to add to those strategies, except maybe one slight thing, which relates specifically to the story that I summed up very, very briefly. It's a much more profound story than anything I said tonight. It goes much deeper, involves many more characters. It involves a series of other turnings by John F. Kennedy and by other people. And so what can be added from that story? I think really just one thing, for me especially, and that is it gives one a lens, you know, a lens. So what does the lens of Kennedy's assassination give one that we wouldn't already have? Well, let me suggest something. I don't think it's simply the lens of the enormity of evil in our government. It certainly does do that. I'm not saying it doesn't do that. But I don't think that's the primary thing that the lens gives one. Nor do I think it's the ingenuity, the diabolical ingenuity of the plot. That's not the primary thing, although there certainly is that understood by studying it. The thing that strikes me comes maybe by asking myself the question as to who the main character in the story is. And I used to think he was John F. Kennedy. Then I thought, well, maybe it's Nikita Khrushchev, because he's the one who initiated and took the deeper step in the missile crisis in some ways, although Kennedy was appealing from the depths of his despair. Then I thought, well, maybe it's humanity, because, you know, we're all in that boat together, as Nikita pointed out. But then when I thought further about this, because it's kind of an enigma to me, this is an extraordinary story. I'm not creating this story. That story is there. That's the reason why we're still here on this planet, rather than it being a nuclear wasteland. And I think, finally, what I felt the main character in the story was something you can call by different names depending on your perspective. Some might call it God. Some might call it enlightenment or nirvana, different kinds of names to it. But it's something that goes beyond a normal understanding of events, or an ordinary understanding of events, or an ordinary sense of cause and effect. At that very moment in history, which was the most critical, when we were on the verge of a total nuclear war between two ideological enemies locked in absolute conflict, they turned to each other. And each enemy saved the other by reaching out a hand. Thomas Merton had prayed for Kennedy, really for all of us somehow, to break through by miracle. That miracle happened. That is a lens of profound hope. The story of John Kennedy's assassination is, in the end, good news. Because he was willing to walk into the darkness in profound isolation, we still have a planet on which to struggle toward the kind of world that Sue was describing. We still have that chance, thanks to the willingness to go into the darkness and into death. That, for me, is a story of hope. So I don't think I have anything new to add in terms of strategies for peace, but maybe a sense of hope that perhaps we all really have at bottom, but this is an illustration of it that goes far beyond anything I had understood before, in the sense of a person under more pressures than any human being I've known, and who managed to walk into the dark.
What do you think about 9/11?
Could have been an inside government operation. Whether or not it was, I don't know, because I have not done the work. But I know that David Ray Griffin, in his series of books, makes a very strong case for that. If you don't know Griffin's work, he was one of the world's greatest authorities in Alfred North Whitehead at Claremont University in California until 9/11 occurred. And then, just as he was going into retirement, he accepted the government story from the beginning, and then things ceased to make sense for him, conflict after conflict of evidence. So he wrote that series of books. I share his questions. I don't know well the answers, but I would be surprised if it was not in the direction that he's talking
about. Are Americans free to question the original story?
Well, to some degree, I'm an American citizen and I raise questions, so, I mean, by definition. But you know, here we have a group of, I don't know how many, at St. Therese on a Sunday evening. Now, if there were 10,000 people here, there might be a little bit more attention being paid to what I'm saying. I haven't experienced the kind of difficulties that the witnesses that I cite in the story have, and certainly not anything even remotely like what John Kennedy experienced or the other three that we were just talking about. In this country, we do have freedom of speech, and we do have ways of asking questions. And I think we are free to do anything we want in this country, so long as we are not effective. So let's try to be a little bit more effective. And I hope that this story can be a little bit effective in raising questions more profoundly. And after all, you know, I wear this around my neck, and I'm not very effective at moving in that direction. But the people that we've talked about were, not because they particularly wanted to be executed. I'm sure they didn't. I know they didn't. But because they wanted to speak and live out the truth. And we all want to do that. That's just part of being human. That's all it is.
I was wondering if you might say a few more words of hope.
The one message of hope that I already shared with you was especially the story of one of the characters in this, and it related to Kennedy's journey and also Khrushchev's journey. But each of the stories that are told that occurred in terms of the witnesses, as you know, witness and martyr mean the same thing. And there are many martyrs in this story, many, many martyrs. It's a huge canvas and unknown to most of us because the media do not carry these stories. There are many stories of hope, and I don't mean that they are necessarily stories that come out well. Of course, we know that hope and optimism are quite different, and hope is quite different from stories coming out well, but stories in which people live their truths more and more deeply and to the point where they are willing to give their lives for the sake of truth and of love. These are deep stories of hope, and I found story after story, and I tried to tell as many as I could. And so people get discouraged. They say, well, these people died, or this man lost his job, or this woman was derailed from her better future. They lived their truths. They lived their truths. And a number of them saw no hope whatever that it would amount to anything in terms of establishing a case that would prove that John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Each of these witnesses, each of these martyrs, has a piece of the truth, just as each of us in very many respects has a piece of the truth. And the story of understanding the truth of the Kennedy assassination is a story of entering into one martyr's life after another. And none of what I said tonight, which is a very small part of things, you know, this is just the tip of the iceberg, would be available were it not for the willingness of person after person to walk his or her talk. And that is a profound story of hope. And this is our story. It is not a story outside of us. It is our story. It is our story. And because they have given their lives to witness to the truth, we have our story in deeper, in a deeper and deeper sense. And through the lens that that story gives, we can hope in a profound sense, because this was a miracle, that we are still alive.
This was a new one for me, so I looked the word up, and martyr does indeed literally mean witness. On one level, this seems like pretty depressing stuff. If people who tell what they've seen and heard are killed so regularly that the two words become synonymous. So as Jim Douglas says, it doesn't always end well for the individual, but looked at on another level, outside, as Charles Eisenstein would say, the frame of the discrete and separate self, it seems like very good news for the human species. As Jim Douglas said, so many martyrs have told their piece of the Kennedy puzzle that the truth is starting to emerge. And if so many people are ready to do that, in spite of the personal consequences to themselves, then keeping such dirty deeds secret looks like a pretty forlorn hope, especially given a broader understanding of how hierarchies work, of how psychopaths tend to dominate those hierarchies, and the long and painful history of psychopathic oppression justified with a superficial, self-serving rhetoric, which, as we've gone over on the show, has myriad forms, but is basically just for show. With more and more people coming to understand what happened on September 11th, 2001, the unspeakable, as Douglas names them, can be under little illusion that they can continue to get away with this stuff. In terms of awareness raising, I think the 9/11 truth movement has been highly successful. A large number of people are now aware that many modern governments are effectively controlled by small groups of psychopaths who are using the state apparatus for their own ends. Now, in terms of what to do about this, I think there's a lot more progress to be made. I see a future in decentralized acts of resistance, acts of disobedience to the authority of the state, obedience to a higher calling. And the example of President Kennedy is one that is worth thinking about. So I would encourage anybody who is listening to this show and wrestling in their own mind with whether they have the courage to do what they know to be right, even if it's going to ruffle feathers or maybe have more severe personal consequences, to step up to the challenge. If humanity hasn't got what it takes to have a broader view, to get outside of the constructed fiction of self-interest, which has been used to prevent altruistic resistance and enforce the rigid hierarchy. If we can't transcend that, then, according to Kennedy's warning, we are doomed. Now, it might not be nuclear war. That prospect seems to have receded. But in its place, we have literally dozens of other ecological catastrophes, all of which, according to Charles Eisenstein's perspective, spring from a disaffection an alienation and separation from nature? Have we collectively got what it takes to repent, to transcend our previous understanding and turn towards the good? Now let's conclude the show with Dr. Martin Luther King, a man who, as we'll hear in the speech, was under no illusions about the risks that he was running, and yet could not be stopped from turning towards the good, and who has been an inspiration to very many, whilst his legacy has been distorted, of course, because it's unacceptable to the corporate media, to the psychopathic message of hierarchy, domination, control, the permanent war for permanent peace institutions. It's all still there if you go and listen to his speeches, and I would encourage you to do that. He's talking a lot about Vietnam, where you can substitute in the modern wars of aggression, and the ideas still ring true, and he still stands for many people as a shining example of a man who has embraced the truth of the greater human self, of the community of all life, and unflinchingly walked into the darkness because the truth must be told. This is from April the 3rd, 1968, the day before he was assassinated by agents of the American state.
It really doesn't matter what happens now. I left Atlanta this morning, and as we got started on the plane, there were six of us. The pilot said over the public address system, "We are sorry for the delay, but we have Dr. Martin Luther King on the plane, and to be sure that all of the bags were checked, and to be sure that nothing would be wrong on the plane, we had to check out everything carefully, and we've had the plane protected and guarded all night." And then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out, or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. My eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
From the widows and orphans, the never hard-working man I oppress. So take your pace easy, go home soon like lightning. We soon will be riding by.
The world is like a ride at an amusement park, and when you choose to go on it, you think it's real, because that's how powerful our minds are. And the ride goes up and down and round. It has thrills and chills, and it's very brightly colored, and it's very loud, and it's fun for a while. Some people have been on the ride for a long time, and they begin to question, is this real, or is this just a ride? And other people have remembered, and they come back to us, and they say, hey, don't worry, don't be afraid, ever, because this is just a ride, and we kill those people. Shut him up. We have a lot invested in this ride. Shut him up. Look at my furrows of worry. Look at my big bank account and my family. This has to be real. It's just a ride. But we always kill those good guys who try and tell us that. You ever notice that? And let the demons run amok. But it doesn't matter because it's just a ride. And we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace. Thank you very much. You've been great. I hope you enjoyed it. London, you're fantastic. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Media used for this episode are at www.unwelcomeguests.net/517. The show has a mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome for anyone interested in giving feedback on the show, suggesting ideas, or otherwise contributing to future episodes. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can. Keep following your heart, following the path of love, not fear, even if it takes you into darkness.